This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode. You may know me as someone who has wasted way too much time thinking about the Time Warner mergers over the past decades, but in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today in the red chair is Machen Delrahim from the United States Justice Department. He's the Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division, one of my favorite divisions of the Justice Department, and has been at the center of the government's attempts to stop Time Warner from merging with AT&T, but also deal with a lot of other issues, many of which will be around tech. Machen, welcome to Recode Decode.
Kara, thanks so much for having me.
I'm thrilled you're here. I know there's certain things you can't talk about. I get that. But I wanted to get people to have one of the things that's happening, I think, a lot is nobody really is talking to each other very well and understanding what's going on around all kinds of issues. And so what I really think is very interesting is to get people talking about where things are going and talking about the bigger ideas. So I'm really pleased you're here to do that. So give us a little background on yourself. I often, whenever I talk to entrepreneurs, I want to give an idea of where people come from and how they get where they've gotten.
Well, it depends when in time you ask.
All right. Go ahead.
I was born in Iran. Mm-hmm. So I was a product of the revolution, came out here in 1979 mm-hmm. when I was about 10 years old with my mm-hmm. family and came to Los Angeles. So I grew up in Los Angeles, even though I probably spent more time outside of Los Angeles. I still consider that. That's where I grew up my formative years. Was there through UCLA undergrad, came out to D.C. to become a patent attorney. Mm-hmm. And I thought nowhere else better. I studied physiology, so I really wanted to be in the biotech. And right around then, the biotech movement had broken
and
with genetics.
Why so?
You know, when I was an undergrad and studying those issues, I loved it. And I'll explain how I demonstrate my love, because I actually did something crazy. I went and get my master's in biotechnology after law school. But I love the sciences. I think it's really important. It has a huge impact on every one of our lives in, you know, medicine. And I was just fascinated by it. So in undergrad, when I was studying, the god of our world was the NIH and the scientists at the National Institutes of Health.
Right.
So I came out here to become a biotech patent lawyer and work at the NIH during the day. And GW back then had one of the, you know, best programs. So I came to D.C., fell in love with the area, went to school at night, and started working at the
NIH. This is getting the biotech after law school.
No, this is in law school.
Law school.
Law school was night for me.
Right.
And I worked at the
NIH. You went to where?
NIH. I went to George Washington, University.
And you worked at NIH. And what was your job? What did it entail?
So the NIH had this thing, probably one of the greatest industrial policies in the United States, was this thing called Bayh-Dole Act. And this is former Senator Birch Bayh and former Senator Bob Dole. Since there's both of those later on, they passed this law that said that inventions that were funded by federal government resources should be allowed under certain conditions to be commercialized and licensed
like the
out
internet,
to the
perhaps.
Well, the internet, you name it, GPS technology. Almost 80% of our biotechnology has some sources and basic research that goes on at the NIH. The AIDS test kit, tamoxifen for breast cancer, you name it. There's many of them, and so some of the world's best scientists are at the NIH, and I love that. And so there was this little office that was involved with patenting the technologies owned by the NIH, and then also commercializing them through licensing, cooperative R&D agreements, direct commercialization, and that was the office I got the chance to get my start
and work in. And you, why didn't you be open a biotech company? I mean, you wanted to be a lawyer for this? What was the thinking?
I've always loved the business side of things. Why I was gravitated to both intellectual property law and antitrust law is I was fascinated by creation, creative creation,
right,
and what the business community had done. Did I ever get a chance to open up a biotech company? Those things are...
Yeah.
You don't just wake up and do that.
Yeah, because right here was quite a few of them were here and in Silicon Valley.
Right outside of 270 corridor,
right
outside. Oh, yeah, quite a few. Silicon Valley and then San Diego.
Right, exactly.
And Boston. And I don't think it's by accident.
Mm-hmm.
Those were right near research universities.
Absolutely, 100%.
Which benefited from the Bayh-Dole Act.
Exactly.
And another piece of law called the Stevenson-Whittler Act, which allowed those to be transferred. So you now had the scientist at either, at Harvard or UC San Francisco or Berkeley, Stanford. They would set up a little company on the side, companies that became, Genentech and Amgen and, Regeneron and whatever they are nowadays. So that's how those little communities developed.
So that's always the best case scenario, where the government does research, there's a university attached to it, and then there's commercial interest. Of everything that's worked rather well, at least in the digital space, that's always worked out rather well. People didn't ever realize why AOL was here, but Mae East was here, the original, and some of the original companies that linked up people to the internet started here after it became commercialized, which was kind of interesting. So you did that, and then?
I had an opportunity. I was kind of the lowest man on the totem pole at the NIH, where during the WTO negotiations, this was, Mickey Cantor was the U.S. trade rep, mid-90s, 94, 95, to be detailed, and I got lent out by the NIH to the U.S. Trade Representative's office to work on the intellectual property chapter of the WTO, which at the time was called the GATT.
Yeah.
And it was the first time in history we had an IP chapter and standards. And one issue had come up was the issue of government subsidies. So in Europe, you had Airbus.
You did.
And you still do, where the government subsidizes.
They were. That was a big deal.
That was a big deal as a competitive factor to Boeing being able to compete in the free markets. And one of the Europeans in those negotiations raised was, hey, look at your biotech industry.
Right.
You guys got all this, tech transfer, which is what it's called, under the Bayh-Dole, and you guys subsidize this whole industry that you guys are a leader in. And so people wanted to know, what is this tech transfer?
Right.
And I got a chance to go. And that was my first taste of policy.
Right.
I was 23-ish or so.
Wow.
And came to work on the trade reps. And it was a phenomenal experience to learn at probably one of the better agencies in all the government.
Talk about that idea of tech transfer. It's really important. I think it's that people forget of how this happens and how. Was it to give advice around the globe or to create a global initiative in that regard?
Well, initially, it was to understand, how does this work in the U.S. government,
right,
and how do you distinguish that from what, foreign countries
which
do
is direct
and provide
subsidies? Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
To which, which distorts the competitive process,
or it can, or sometimes people look at it in a good way. We can talk about that later, because what's going on in Korea, where people feel that that's a great thing for the go, or even if you go back before that, telephones. The telephone subsidies that were happening to create that, which create different. There's different ways to do it.
Different ways, but when you do that to create national champions to distort competition in that race that should occur, hopefully, in free competition, that was the issue. So people wanted to understand. And then when I got there, I got tasked with doing a lot of things that was at the time going on, which dealt with both bilateral and multilateral. And it was the implementation of that WTO agreement. So that was the first real taste I had of policy.
Yeah.
And probably change the direction, because otherwise I was going to do my work at NIH, finish law school, and move somewhere in the sun between Santa Barbara and San Diego.
And then just work for biotech firms.
Or, practice law or
practice
do
law.
Something.
So
that's what I would have done.
So then you did practice law then?
I did. So I left the trade rep's office. I did a health fellowship working for Orrin Hatch on the Senate Judiciary Committee, dealing with the export of biotech and food and drug laws. Back then, our U.S. laws were, if you had a drug or device that had been approved abroad in, let's say, in Germany, but had not been approved by the FDA, you couldn't export that.
Right.
And so the U.S. laws, got reformed. I want to say that was 90, 95-ish or so, 94, 95 later. And then I went, when I graduated, I joined a law firm, Patton Boggs, here in D.C.
Big one.
Where I got to, again, see a different side of things. They didn't have a patent practice. And so I was doing more, some copyright and then antitrust law.
Right, which is where you got into that.
That's where I got more into that, and I was already fascinated by it.
In that, is that where you work for, a number of tech? I've run into a lot of tech companies who you've worked for. That's just recently an executive. Yeah. I'm not going to name who it is, but it was you started to work for tech companies in general.
I did. I did some work over there. I did for some tech companies. I did for some, you know, plain old merger work for paper companies.
Right.
I did some telecom. That was
What's paper.
A paper.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Technology of corrugated paper.
Yes.
It's
a good technology. It works well for Amazon.
You know, it's a huge part of our market.
Yeah, it is.
The law firm had acquired a telecom practice, and at the time, remember, it was right before the 1996 Telecom Act.
Yes.
So that was going on. Patton Boggs was heavily involved with the reform of the law, but also had a lot of clients in the regulatory side. And so I did some antitrust work. And then I got a chance to go work for the Senate Judiciary Committee on the Microsoft investigation.
Yeah.
So Orrin Hatch led the investigation in that after some complaints. His then the Senate Judiciary's chief of staff had called me because I had done, remember, about a 5-month little fellowship on the health stuff. And so I'd gotten to know some of them, but they contacted me, said, "Hey, would you have any interest to come work on antitrust?" And
so talk about that. Was that the first time you sort of got to see the power of Silicon Valley? I covered that for the Washington Post, but it was a remarkably important case. I don't think people think hard enough about what it meant, what that particular case meant. How did you look at that?
I saw not only the power of Silicon Valley, but power of technology. You saw a lot of companies who were coming together. But, you know, you saw what was the anti-competitive conduct, what was alleged, and you had many cases of folks who were saying, "Hey, I'm getting crushed because
lots and lots of
this company
AOL,
cannot."
Including Netscape.
We had Netscape. That was the one where Mark Andreessen and Jim Barksdale. You also had Scott McNeely at Sun at the time and Larry Ellison.
Right.
At Oracle. But so I got involved with that AOL at the time was very much AOL Time Warner merger was a hearing I worked on back then. So a lot of these things kind of come back. And then copyright as well. There was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Right.
I wasn't the principal staffer on that, but I was there when that was happening. And there was an interesting time because there were a lot of provisions and laws that were made then that has, to this day, has huge impact on
the
tech industry.
So what did you think at the time? We want to move forward to today, but what was your inkling at the time as these were happening? Because the Microsoft merger, everyone thought it would take care of the situation, that it would free everybody up to compete and everything else. And then all that happened is there's enormous, powerful companies now, and now there's lots of them.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the merger probably allowed for some of those companies to flourish.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, you question, you kind of never know. That's one of always the challenges in antitrust enforcement.
Right.
It's always prospective. But you also, you know, you that's why sometimes the job is difficult. You always have to come in every day and try to get it right.
Right.
And
because you don't want to hinder innovation.
You don't. That's, I think, our most important aspect of U.S. antitrust law is not hindering that and actually creating the culture for innovation, partly because, not partly, but largely because innovation is actually what creates competition to topple incumbents.
Presumably. Yes.
Presumably.
Right.
I mean, you know, you have, a Netflix or Amazon that provide consumers what they wanted that they could have probably had had the many MVPDs allowed for that.
Right.
MVPDs being the cable operators or others. But when the incentives aren't there financially to do that, all of a sudden you have now with the advent of internet and online streaming.
It's not just incentives, it's the thinking of doing it.
Right. There could be the thinking, but when the incentive isn't there, it gets killed.
It gets killed.
That's why you have entrepreneurs breaking off and starting these little startups.
So what impact did that we're going to get on that in the next section, but before we finish this one up, what impact do you think the Microsoft trial had when you look back on it?
I think it had a number of impacts. One, importantly, it reinforced the consensus antitrust view, which was upheld by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals under traditional antitrust analysis that was applied to those acts. So Joel Klein and the Justice Department who brought the case and tried that, there's a lot of folks, naysayers, you know, you guys are crazy what is happening there, whether it was, you know, certain editorial pages, you're interfering with business. But at the at its core, in my view, antitrust it protects that free market. And that showed that those practices were wrong and they were crushing innovation.
Right.
So I think it made perhaps Microsoft a, you know, I think a better corporate citizen. You know, their business hasn't been harmed, but other businesses were able to get off the ground.
Right.
I think, you know, I don't know if Apple would be the trillion-dollar company had it not been for that, partly because a new phone would have come on and you would have had to have had the operating Microsoft operating system.
Right.
Rather than the Apple, which then flourished in App Store and others. So I think a lot of innovation has occurred probably because of that, but, you know, who knows?
What's interesting is people don't realize Google came after Microsoft, really. You know what I mean? A lot of things, things that you don't even think about, came after that trial.
And could Google have survived had Microsoft wanted to put its own search engine as the preferred search engine in every operating system, which was 98% of every computer, and then every phone?
Right.
And the only search engine you could have had, because without it, you wouldn't have been able to have access to the operating system.
Right.
Then where would that search engine have been? So, you know.
You might not even have had a phone, because Microsoft had a lot of disdain for phones at the time, if you remember. I mean, I remember.
A lot of companies who have a lot of disdain for new technology.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Things.
All right, we're here with Megan Delrahim. He's the Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Justice Department. We're going to take a quick break. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on now. We've just been talking about the history of some things that he's been doing over the years.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
We're back with Megan Delrahim. He's the Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Justice Department. Let's fast forward today. So you have all these companies, they've grown up, and I think the Microsoft trial was sort of the great moment for tech when people realized the power of tech, and not just in terms of money that these people had, Bill Gates being the richest man in the world at the time, I think. I'm not sure if he is now. He's up there. He's still up there. He remains as rich as ever. But it was sort of a, it was like a moment for Silicon Valley and when the real innovation began to start in Silicon. I think most people feel, despite the fact there had been so much going on with computers before that. You worked for a whole bunch of different companies after that in the ensuing years. How do you look at Silicon Valley right now? Because a lot of people in Europe and elsewhere feel like it needs to be pulled back. And we'll talk about, we can't talk specifically about your case, or maybe you can a little bit, but how do you look at it overall when you're thinking about these powers? We've created, it's a really an American-made industry right now, and of course it's getting a lot of pressure from China and other places, largely from China. How do you look at it overall when you think about the tech industry here in this country?
I look at it with a sense of pride as an American, but also that we are able to have some of the best minds and, and a community that is able to try, fail, succeed, and have a very fertile ground for innovation. And innovation, in my view, is really what ultimately helps the consumer. It's dynamic competition. Mm-hmm. When you have those new products, new services being brought to the consumer, and we just don't know what we don't know.
Right.
We'd have no, who would have thunk 20 years ago, mm-hmm. we would have the technologies we have today.
No one.
That every one of these phones can be a television, which they are now. Mm-hmm. You can broadcast and have mm-hmm. podcasts without having to go through a local broadcaster or a TV station. Mm-hmm. So I think the consumers have benefited immensely. And what it has allowed is it's allowed dissemination of information to mm-hmm. a lot more people than otherwise mm-hmm. would be able to get.
Mm-hmm. And what do you, when you look at that, many people though feel now that it's gotten to a point that they're too powerful. There's obviously hearings going to happen this week. There's all kinds of issues, and I don't want to get into every one of them, but there's a growing sense that these companies are too large, that they're too, that they need some sort of either regulation or we're in an interesting moment, and especially an antitrust moment. How do you look at them now as they are? Because they have innovated a lot, but you have these big companies, you have Apple, Google, Facebook, not really Microsoft anymore, which is kind of ironic if you think about it, sort of dominating everything, especially, for example, Google and Facebook in the advertising space almost completely. But it's not one single company. It's like five or six of them. I liken them to a bunch of semis running down the highway with nobody able to get around them in a lot of ways.
In some ways, I think that is true. The question is that momentary? Mm-hmm. Is it is that a reward of their superior acumen, mm-hmm. investment, risk mm-hmm. that they have taken? It wasn't that long ago where Netflix, who's mm-hmm. considered one of the FANG companies, was under siege.
Right. I mean,
they were nowhere.
Right.
They shouldn't have survived. Mm-hmm. But I think kudos to Reed Hastings and those folks who persevered over, I forget now, the company.
All of them.
Oh, well,
Time
Blockbuster.
Warner.
Well, it was
Blockbuster.
Time Warner.
Yeah.
Blockbuster.
Yeah.
You had folks.
I don't know if you remember Jeff Bukas called them Lithuanians. He called them, they weren't going to make it. He essentially insulted them on stage several times.
Mr. Bukas has had very colorful language.
Yeah.
And he referred to Sling, during our trial certain ways. But no, absolutely. And these folks survive mm-hmm. despite all odds. Mm-hmm. And they create something new mm-hmm. And that people want. And then that is emulated. Mm-hmm. And then folks try to kill them again because now this creating competition. So I think that what they do could be temporary. Mm-hmm. As long as the barriers to entry for mm-hmm. competition are still low, mm-hmm. somebody can enter, there was room mm-hmm. for Snapchat mm-hmm. to come mm-hmm. out and compete mm-hmm. at some level, partly because consumers preferred maybe a disappearing snap, in 24 hours.
Right.
And I think there's room there for consumers to try out and for innovators. And that's mm-hmm. what we do not want to punish mm-hmm. that competitor who we've encouraged them to compete and succeed.
Right.
Once they succeed, we do not want to get them out of the business.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important that our policies don't discourage that.
Right.
It's not, go out, compete, be successful, but only to a limit.
Mm-hmm.
That's not our economy, mm-hmm. and I don't think that is good for our economy. We want every one of them to become monopolists mm-hmm. as long as they're behaving properly.
I see.
We don't want them to, once they are there, mm-hmm. now try to block and create a moat around themselves
right.
in an inappropriate way.
Right.
So that's the way I look at it.
So Europeans see it differently. They feel as if these companies have gotten untold power and are advantaging themselves. And the U.S. government has been relatively hands-off on a lot of it for a long, long time. And you feel that's the best policy still?
Well, it depends. Mm-hmm. So my job isn't really, one of my legal heroes is mm-hmm. former justice and head of the antitrust division at one point, Robert Jackson, mm-hmm. who in FDR about mm-hmm. 80 years ago has mm-hmm. given some great speeches, and mm-hmm. I've read all of them.
Is that a legal hero?
Absolutely.
I'm teasing.
He is an absolute legal
Why
hero.
Why is that?
Oh, he's one of the greatest legal mm-hmm. minds. Mm-hmm. He had a huge impact that to this day we feel it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wrote some of the dissents in mm-hmm. Korematsu mm-hmm. and some of the most significant cases. He was a prosecutor at the Nuremberg trial.
Mm-hmm.
But in antitrust, he actually saved, I think, the direction of the country
mm-hmm.
at the time when we were looking to see whether we should be focused on markets and let markets decide prices and direction,
right.
as opposed to the government directing.
Right.
Remember, around that time after the World War and leading up to World War II, we were debating whether or not we should set prices and determine what products and output should be out there mm-hmm. because of steel and other needs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big debate. And I think he prevailed and allowed the free market to survive. Now, we make mistakes in enforcement, and we get corrected, you know, by the courts and the Supreme Court that sets the guidelines and determines kind of the contours of antitrust over time. But I think there's a right balance. We need to be vigilant, making sure, I think, you know, timely and vigorous enforcement of the antitrust laws, like in Microsoft or other cases that may come up, is really important, because if you don't do that, then you do have failure in the market, and that's when there's calls for regulation.
Right.
That's where Congress then steps in and says, well, you can only have 30% programming, and now you have a very static government rules that might be arbitrary, but that's what the law is.
Right.
And those only come in when there's been a failure in the marketplace. And to me, a failure in the marketplace could mean a failure in enforcement of the free market.
So let's fast forward then to your recent case. I know you can't talk things that are currently in litigation, but you lost a case, the AT&T case, and you have all since appealed. What can you talk about it? What can you say about that case right now?
Well, look, it's an important case. It's one of the first of that has been litigated, not the first challenge. There's a lot of folks talking about vertical mergers versus horizontal vertical.
Can you explain that for people who don't understand?
Sure. It depends on where in that chain of supply it is. So a vertical would be a distributor that buys an input, a product that they would sell. So let's say, well, a perfect example is AT&T or Comcast, they're distributors of programming content, and Time Warner or NBC and Universal, they're the creators of the program. So Time Warner would normally be incentivized to sell to all distributors that ultimately get to the marketplace. If AT&T is a distributor, owns it, those incentives change of whether or not they want to sell it to other distributors, because all of a sudden, they're now the owner and also a vendor to a competitor. And so that dynamic changes. It's, you know, these sometimes these concepts can be complicated, but it's relatively simple. Is, you know, do those bargaining powers change with that type of a merger? Some people, including the merging parties, criticized us that it's the first time we've ever enforced. Well, that's not the case, because if people remember Comcast and NBC in the prior administration, it was settled. It was a case that was actually filed and simultaneously settled with a 7-year consent decree that prevented Comcast from taking certain actions in violation of the antitrust laws. And so the issue wasn't that it wasn't. It was just not settled. And those settlements, I've given speeches, I've written about these, I think is actually not good for the consumer.
Why
because
is that? So your point is that the government had objections to it and they settled it before it got to trust. So that they,
correct.
Which typically happens. As
which
in many,
many times happens, absolutely. But so there's different types of settlements. So in that particular one,
and this is Comcast,
NBC, what are called behavioral remedies. So a behavioral settlement. And what it means is that you, Kara, cannot do certain things for the next 7 years or 5 years or 20 years. As opposed to what we call a structural settlement, saying, okay, hey, this is the problem that causes the competitive consumer harm. You better sell off that business.
Right, and get rid of it.
Get rid of it, and let's create the same competitive landscape by having somebody else run it with
or
the incentive to maximize it.
Right.
Rather than saying, you know, you're the tiger, you're going to be walking down the you know, Fifth Avenue in Manhattan.
Example.
And we're just going to, we're going to ask you to promise.
Not to bite people.
Not to bite people. And, you know, maybe you'll agree for 5 years, but after 5 years, you're going to bite people. So it requires the antitrust enforcer to now step into the role of a regulator of that business, which again, I don't think I or many people are smart enough to guess 7 years from now
what
where technology will be, what the consumer or business model will be, and whether or not that'll be good.
So you, structural remedy was
structural remedies, I think, is the preferred one, if it's possible. And I thought in the AT&T Time Warner case.
So in the previous case, which was a similar to the Comcast NBC one, there was a consent decree. It's still enforced.
For another 3 days.
Is it 3 days? From
September 1, it expires.
Wow.
And the
tiger
FCC
will start
one
eating,
turned. Well, you would, you know, who knows if it will. You hope that there's, but certainly the marketplace hasn't really changed to a certain degree. Now, there was a hope that there would be online competition by streaming and cord cutters, and we do have that. However, if network neutrality rules are not in place, you tell me if an incumbent has the same incentives to allow free, unfettered access to somebody who now competes with
them. We will see what they'll do. So in this case, you decided a structural remedy was the best case, which I read your...
Because it was available. I mean, you know, I'd say probably 80% of the merger I would have found would be, we found in our model and economic models, would be actually pro-consumer, pro-competitive. You know, AT&T could own HBO, but that doesn't mean, you know, another distributor could not own a Showtime. Maybe it is not as good as HBO, but they could. Because now they'll have the incentive to be better. Or, you know, Stars or, you name it, Flix or Netflix. And so there's ways of doing that. You know, and the studio was fine. You know, they could own the studio. Could they keep some of that content away? Yes, but there was a competitive studio market. You have seven other studios that create the content. The area of sports and, you know, was the area that our economists found, and that's what we did. But, you know, the district court judge did not agree. The district court judge, you know, one of our issues on appeal is that there was some fundamental mistakes in logic that apply to that case. It's laid out in our appellate brief. It's also laid out in six amicus briefs that were filed on our side, including one from 29 very prominent scholars, including Professor Hovenkamp, who writes the treatise in antitrust law out of University of Pennsylvania, Professors Doug Melamed and
give others. Your easiest lawyer version of what you're appealing.
Here's the simplest one.
But before we do that, the judge ruled against you. The merger has gone forward.
Judge said that we did not meet our burden of proof. So the government has a burden of proof by preponderance of 51%.
That this will cause harm.
But the judge ruled almost, you know, that we didn't make a single point in this case, and that, you know, it was implausible, some of the evidence that was put forward. So it was an interesting, you know, application of some of the evidence and standards. So we'll see what the Court of Appeals will decide later this year, hopefully. We entered into an understanding with AT&T that they would keep the Turner business separate until February 2019, pending appeal. Or earlier if the appeal decides that, you know, they're fine. So that allows, in the event we win, to allow for a structural remedy for them to sell that business off.
Off to the one side as the merger goes
forward. To somebody else.
Right. As the merger goes forward.
Well, the merger, they close. We let them close.
I know. It's,
And as a condition, you know, we did not seek emergency appeal. If we sought emergency appeal, the deal could have unraveled. And two-thirds of that deal was not, you know, problematic. And as long as they kept that business separate, then, you know, we go through a regular orderly process. So in the simplest form, here's what the judge, you know, one of the mistakes in that ruling that we assert out in our appeal is he said that it is, you know, it is implausible that a subsidiary of a company, a wholly owned subsidiary. So let's say there's company parent that owns two subsidiaries.
Right.
And just for the purpose of simplicity, that subsidiary A, he said it's implausible that subsidiary A would ever sacrifice, let's just say that they get $2 of revenue a year, that they would sacrifice $1 of revenue a year in order for the parent to make an extra three.
Right.
Which, you know, just pure economics says if any of those subsidiaries every single day and three times on Wednesdays, you'd be willing to give up $1 to get $3.
Right.
Who wouldn't? But he said, no, they'll make independent financial decisions. But that independence goes away when they're owned by the same company and has one, you know, profit and loss balance sheet. So that is something that has been recognized by the Supreme Court, that has been recognized by every economist, that that is the, one of the most fundamental parts of when you have one entity. And then at the same time, he said that, you know, there's benefits, there's efficiencies that the consumer would benefit. And we said that there could be up to a certain amount, but that only goes if, so if, you know, when you combine a distributor and a, and a content provider, a concept in economics called, you know, elimination of double marginalization, then both of them will seek to get some kind of a profit to survive. Once they're combined, you presume maybe they could do away with one of those margins in order to compete with their competitors.
Right.
So technically, prices could go down.
Mm-hmm.
And we said that could. But that only happens if you believe in the same unit entity working to maximize the overall profit because you're now competing to get market share. If it was implausible that they would ever eliminate this, so you can't have this internal inconsistency in the opinion, which, you know, in my view, is the 13th chime of the clock.
Mm-hmm.
It puts a big shadow on the question of the logic that was applied in this case. The judge said, look, you know, I can't believe that I have, this was a first antitrust case, that I have to have a crystal ball to look ahead prospective. Well, that's what antitrust merger law is. You have to look what happens in the future.
In the future.
And you have to dip it in the bud.
So were you surprised by the ruling?
I was surprised by the way it was written. And yeah, I was.
Yeah. And so when you go forward with this, if it is not ruled in your favor, it just moves forward, correct? What are the two outcomes that could happen? The appeals court agrees with you.
If the appeals court agrees with us, it could be, for example, remanded to a district court for reconsideration according to whatever they rule. They could deny our appeal and uphold the district court.
Right.
And that'll be, you know, that could be the end of that. But both parties will also have the chance to either go further in appeal. So if, let's say, AT&T loses, presumably they could ask for either an en banc hearing or go to the Supreme Court, and we would. But, you know, that would be our choices. But, you know, whether or not this is the type of case.
Was there a thought not to appeal, or you felt, from your perspective?
Sure. You always consider whether you should or not, because there's a risk that you would then set a bad precedent now that is a larger bad precedent. But this was, the opinion was so flawed that I thought it was really important to get in this area. There isn't guidance to the to the business community. What are the contours? What should be the limits? And many people said, well, this is so fact-based that this is limited to this, but not an antitrust. There's not that many antitrust litigations. So these have an outsized impact on the business community. And I think it's important to have guidance and clarify the errors. Now, if you know, if the court rules that we
then
were wrong,
the rules of the game, then that'll be the
That's exactly right.
So, lastly, in this section, and then I want to talk about where the future is going with all these companies. You got dragged into a political fight. How much pressure was that on you? Because most the president had said very negative things about CNN and continues to do. How did you address that? Did you ignore it, or how did you feel about that?
Well, AT&T tried to make an issue of it.
Trump's pretty loud about CNN.
Well, he did. He had made some comments.
Before he was
president during the campaign, but he wasn't the only one. I think the other candidates, including Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders, have said that. I forget maybe 20 senators who wrote to me saying that block this merger or do not do a behavioral remedy or something. So this was a bipartisan criticism about this transaction and consolidation in general. Now, it makes no sense and that the merger action was brought because of somehow an animus to CNN.
Yeah.
Because if you actually logically think about the case, what we were arguing was to have Time Warner distribute Tribune, which includes CNN, as broadly as possible. Because our theory is if it's merged, then you won't distribute broadly in order to seek rent for DirecTV. And, you know, are you going to give up a couple of bucks of a license fee for a channel in order to gain a new subscriber of DirecTV that might be worth $1,500?
Right.
You know, that's, again, that's the math that we were dealing with. So the logic made no sense. And the judge shut that part down. And they said that, you know, that they tried to make that. But there was a major PR effort by AT&T in this case. And it was salacious enough that if people were not familiar with antitrust law and exactly what we were arguing, oh, this might be, but it really wasn't, and had nothing to do with it.
The pressure from that?
Oh, this, you know, these jobs come with part of that pressure. You just kind of, you do what you do. Again, Justice Jackson, you know, you go back and read him and about, you know, he gave a beautiful speech in the Great Hall to the second gathering of the U.S. attorneys in 1940 at Justice, where To this day, I think it is. It should be a model for every law enforcement official
and
federal prosecutor. I said, you know, we have a huge role as prosecutors. Mm-hmm. We, you know, you can indict, you can prosecute, you can do a lot of things, and the Constitution empowers you, but you have to do the right thing. And the reason why you are in these jobs and it requires, you know, presidential appointment and Senate confirmation is that you have to win, you know, a seal of approval of your character by not only the executive branch, which is the branch that appoints you, the president, but also from the legislative branch, which is the Senate that has to confirm you. And an important part and says, you know, you really need to factor in, and you don't go after individuals, you go after cases.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to take a look. Exactly, and make the case. And he said back then, 80 years ago, that if you go after individuals, there's enough laws on the book where you almost, and this is back then where the federal law books were probably like this, as opposed to today, is that you'll be able to find a violation on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think it holds even more true today.
Absolutely. We're here with Machen Delrahim. That's a very thoughtful thing to say. He's the Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Justice Department. We're just talking about his involvement with the AT&T Time Warner merger. And when we get back, we're going to talk about the future of antitrust law, especially when it relates to tech and media.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
We're here with Machen Delrahim. He's the Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Justice Department. So going forward, this appeal will either happen or it won't. And people either accuse you of carrying water for the president or not. It doesn't really matter.
Sure.
But one of the interesting parts of the case, besides the allegations of interference by President Trump, was that AT&T and others, big telcos, were talking about the idea that they were under siege by the internet companies, which is, to me, is mind-blowing if you think about it. And actually, they are in a lot of ways. Media companies are, telcos are, everybody's sort of fighting for the consumer. When you think about that from an antitrust perspective, how does the landscape going forward look to you? Because I think it's going to be very complex for the government to try to figure out how to regulate and control this.
So that is interesting. I mean, it's always fascinating when incumbents say, I can't compete with these new innovators.
Right, exactly.
Save us. You need to approve otherwise illegal merger
right.
so that I can compete with somebody who's killing me in competition. I think that's even more important.
Allegedly illegal. Right now it is not.
Allegedly. Okay. Well, interestingly, the opinion, the judge went on and on talking about why, because of Amazon and Netflix and Facebook.
Yeah, that's right. That's
they
why
need to.
This.
And he said that these are vertically integrated. Therefore, I need to vertically integrate these companies.
Yeah, that's my point.
The fascinating part is you tell me, and it's not lost on most of the American public, that, you know, Netflix and, you know, Sling or Amazon or any of these other companies that need to reach any one of us as consumers, they're not vertically integrated in what we're talking about. Why? Because they still need to go through a cable pipe or a wireless network to be able to access, which, again, gets back to the network neutrality issue. They still need to get through us, through them, to get to us.
Right.
That's the difference between vertical integration there as opposed to
they don't have the distributing
a Comcast or AT&T or a Verizon owning one of those companies or the content. Right. So Netflix had to invest and create this new content area, as did Amazon, to, you know, go and produce and compete.
Right.
They had to pay that producer that produces whatever, House of Cards for $5 million an episode. And they had to compete with HBO and NBC in order to buy that and put it on their network. They paid more. That's all it means. But if they can't, if they get throttled, I mean, you saw the recent news this week about Verizon, you know, rolling back the firefighters. So the power is there to do so when you're somebody is competing with them, and the incentive will be there. And so that isn't vertical integration. That's
but
another
Megan,
major
promise
mistake.
Not to,
exactly, of course. As long as
the
they promise, it'll be fine. So, frankly, I think I am very skeptical of those types of arguments. It certainly is. I mean, it's just ludicrous to even think about it here. That hey, we can't. Well, there's nothing to stop Time Warner from going directly to consumers, you know, the technology, be able to go directly, just like Netflix or Amazon does. You don't need to buy a satellite dish and a wireless network and a fiber line as they did in order to get to the consumer. You don't need to do that. Just you already actually have a huge studio, an incredible library, one of the most cherished content, you know, with
so
Batman,
what they have
Harry
is already
Potter.
Volume. They're not going to die because...
They wouldn't die if they actually wanted to compete with those people. And same thing with, you know...
the telcos.
The telcos. You know, go out and, you know, compete directly for that. Yes, if the consumer...
I mean, make it on their own. Make their own stuff without buying it.
Right. Well, here they could have bought, you know, even Warner Brothers Studios and HBO and Cinemax to be able to do that. But in our economic model, that wouldn't have caused the same harm because it actually would have created more competition and more choices.
Right.
But what is interesting is that they could have done that. That argument was, you know, was a, in my view, was a kind of...
the scary internet people.
Yeah, and it was one where, you know, most people wouldn't have, would have seen right through that. The judge bought the whole thing and cited it in the opinion, which... you know, hopefully the Court of Appeals will pay attention to it.
So if you do want to go down that road and believe that the Googles and the Facebooks are and Amazons are very powerful, what can they buy? Because a lot of people feel they're going to start doing the exact same thing. Like someone just the other day said that, for example, they wouldn't have allowed, it was a lawyer I was talking to, and they said they wouldn't have allowed WhatsApp to happen today, Facebook buying WhatsApp or Google buying YouTube or things like that that happened before.
Perhaps. I mean, if they were at the same place. So this was raised to be about Google and YouTube, just as an example. And I'm not saying that those companies are, you know, are you know, per se legal or every activity is legal. They could very well be violating the antitrust laws down the road if they take certain actions. But just taking a look at YouTube, back when they purchased YouTube, was it the robust content distributor that it is today online? I don't think so. Did it benefit from the technology and the resources that Google had in order to make it what it is? Yes. And that's the efficiency that is positive. That's when mergers, you know, 95%
like
of which—
Facebook buying Instagram or—
Facebook buying Instagram is another one. Now, you know, if Instagram was an actual— like it is today, back when they bought it, you know, does that raise competitive problems? Probably. Mm-hmm. But would Instagram be what it is today without Facebook?
Right.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. And those are times and snapshots that enforcers need to be really vigilant. Mm-hmm. They need to look at it. They need to look at not only the price factors, mm-hmm. output, innovation, mm-hmm. quality, and seeing that, you know, does this merger harm the, you know, the competitive process in mm-hmm. any way? Mm-hmm. And if so, they need to step in. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be afraid of, you know, politics or the PR mm-hmm. that those companies can bring down.
Right.
I know that Joel Klein and the Clinton administration.
Who's now at Facebook?
Is he at Facebook?
Facebook.
I did not know that.
No, Kaplan is. I'm sorry.
Well, Joel Kaplan is.
Yeah.
But Klein, who was the head of the antitrust division under Clinton.
At the Microsoft.
You know, they were under a huge fire by mm-hmm. Microsoft at that time.
Yes, they were.
You know, there were senators standing up, you know, threatening to, in fact, not only threatening, but actually trying to mm-hmm. Defund the antitrust division at the time, defund mm-hmm. Joel's car access mm-hmm. or, you know, silly things like that, mm-hmm. Which, you know, ultimately were not successful. Mm-hmm. But those are important factors to consider is disregard that type of heat that'll come on you. Do the job that you took the oath to do.
So you, when these come, these are inevitably going to come down the pike, these mergers, as these companies get more and more powerful. I think they are, that they will start buying up lots and lots of things. You wouldn't surprise, say, you know, I've always thought someone will buy Disney, but maybe not now with the other merger going on, but that there's going to be massive consolidation of these companies. Do you anticipate that, or you just wait and see what comes down the road?
Well, you have to just wait and see. You don't mm-hmm. know what will trigger, you know, that type of a merger or activity mm-hmm. Or why or when mm-hmm. if it happens. Now, I've heard that, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, Apple buying a content company,
yes.
but or that they grow it organically.
Right.
You want them to grow organically.
Right.
And you want them to succeed.
Right.
You want them to topple
right.
An incumbent mm-hmm. to the extent that any of those companies can. But if they actually merge and mm-hmm. do so,
by
and if
Disney,
it shows that it would be a violation. Well, and that's the question. You know, would that violate the antitrust laws? You know, these things are very fact-specific. Mm-hmm. You know, would that violate? And that's where, if it does, you need to go to court and stop it.
So let me finish up by talking about the idea of where antitrust is going. When you think about things like, does it have to change in this era? When they could all argue there is plenty, there's a lot of them, right? There's a lot of, but they don't actually compete with each other in a weird way. Facebook doesn't actually compete with Google.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Neither does Amazon. They're all sort of.
And you hope they haven't agreed to not
compete.
Right,
right. No. Yeah, they all get together and trade our private information and then move along.
They tried. I mean, you know, Google tried many times to create, you know, Google Plus.
Yes.
They tried to do different things.
Did.
And it just didn't.
They were bad at it. They're not very social. I don't know if you know those people, but they're not good at social things. But in terms of when you look at the future of antitrust, I'd just love to get your sort of high-level idea of where you think it's going, and especially in light of the fact that Europe and other places are becoming more stringent on these large mega companies.
So let me take those in two different ways, because there's an important factor on the mm-hmm. international side, mm-hmm. because there's no international code, but then there's one about domestic and where mm-hmm. is the law and where should it go? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the law is flexible mm-hmm. as it is today. I think there's broad consensus on the left, the right, the middle, everywhere on this, that, you know, as long as you can have credible evidence, I think you need to have the will to be aggressive in a timely fashion mm-hmm. Before you kill off too many companies and innovators mm-hmm. to step in where there is the evidence and it's, you know, it shows that there would be an anti-competitive conduct or effect. And you want to do that. I think the law is flexible enough as we have it. Mm-hmm. Again, like the Microsoft case, mm-hmm. we'll always be challenged by new technology mm-hmm. and new practices, particularly mm-hmm. in digital. Mm-hmm. You have what are called network effects. So it's a winner take all mm-hmm. That could cause issues. You have issues dealing with big data mm-hmm. that people talk about. And you have to take a look at that and how does that really fit into ultimately what benefits the consumer and the free market. Mm-hmm. So I think the law is flexible. We'll see. You know, sometimes courts could get things wrong.
Right.
And then, you know, that's really up to Congress to then mm-hmm. change that after a debate, you know, where there has been market failure, like in telecom where there used mm-hmm. to be, or cable with the 92 telecom cable act. Then there is the issue of the international, mm-hmm. you know, are more aggressive enforcers better? Mm-hmm. Does that mean that they're better at antitrust or better mm-hmm. for the marketplace? I don't think so. I think there needs to be a I hope that we continue to diverge. I'm very heartened that the fact that over the years we have had more and more convergence on the principles, and we got to be vigilant, make sure we don't diverge on the fundamental basics of, you know, economics-based antitrust application. We don't have an international agreement. We don't have an agreement about how you view this. And one of the more dangerous things, I think, you know, that could happen moving forward is that a country uses the antitrust laws as a weapon against, as an economic weapon against one of our companies or,
or an
industry. In their country.
In their country to fight. Well, they've done, they do that in Europe. I mean, interesting, I interviewed President Obama. He said the Europeans are just doing it to hurt Google. And I was like, some people could feel Google's a little strong.
Well, that's, you know, President Obama and President Trump seem to agree on
that. Yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. Yeah. And I'd like to, you know, make sure, because I don't think it would be fair for us to second guess their enforcement decisions if we don't have the same evidence and analysis.
Right.
So I think it's really important for us to also look at that.
Yeah, because here in this country, Yelp has some opinions about that. You know,
Yelp has it. Many other, you know, content companies have those views. So we have that. And there's, I think, a couple of maybe a state attorney general in Missouri has brought a case or investigation in Google. But, and you know, the Federal Trade Commission in 2013 had one.
They did.
So, but I think we need to make sure that that doesn't happen, that they don't use that, because it's really easy to apply nebulous economic standards and say, you know, you are charging too high of a price for your patent or your copyrighted content. And therefore, it's a violation of our antitrust law, because now you're escaping other, you know, potentially trade agreements on IP or other areas, because now it's you're doing it enforcing antitrust. And we need to be very careful not to do that.
Not to do this.
Not to make sure that other countries don't do that. A big part of my job now, which, you know, probably wasn't 20 years ago in that in this job, is lots of international engagement. We are, you know, I have a full, just a full-time deputy for international who focuses on it. We have announced a multilateral agreement just on basic procedures that, you know, requires a commitment from all of our trading partners to not treat a foreign national any differently than the way you would treat it. We took a number of concepts from trade and antitrust and international agreements to come up with a standard that would work for countries that have different legal and political regimes. And I've been very heartened by the Brazilians, Mexican, Canadian, many other countries that have signed on and to help us negotiate that. We're negotiating.
Right. Because they're much stricter. I mean, I've heard calls from them for breakups.
But this is...
But
this is basic due process is all we're calling for. So we're not asking for an actual standard of law.
But
it basically says you would allow for, you know, to look at, you know, to have attorney-client privilege, the right to counsel.
Right.
Some of the most fundamental procedural norms that almost every regime recognizes,
we are saying to do that.
At least it's a good start.
But do you see, I mean, just the other day, someone from Europe was talking about breaking up Facebook, for example.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of those calls. And you know, people get a lot of headlines and attention by calling on, you know, antitrust actions or breaking up this company and that company. It happens in the United States. We've heard this the last couple of years. So I think that we got to do what we have to do.
They're all coming to Washington next week to talk.
I did see that. And there's broader policies. You know, the issues, really important issues on data protection. There's really important issues of privacy. And these are important policy issues that the legislative branch and the executive branch should consider. Fortunately, it's outside of antitrust law, largely.
You'll watch
I don't have
them,
to worry about that. Of course, we'll watch them.
Yeah. What could one of these things do that would you go, wait a second?
Well, I mean, if they coordinated with each other, you know, entered into an agreement to do certain things or stay out of each other's markets.
You know, they're all at the Palo Alto Starbucks right now planning.
Or they might be going to, you know, what is that, in Sun Valley or something.
Oh, they're all, are you kidding? They're all plotting there.
No,
you have
so I
to
don't,
go. You don't
think,
go there? They're not let you in?
They have not let me in there.
Okay.
That's a different club.
Because you'll rifle through their hotel rooms.
But it's an interesting one that, you know, we actually look for the evidence of the wrongdoing. So that's, I think, an important aspect is then if there is, then we'll go after them.
Okay. And how long are you going to stay in this job, Megan?
Oh, I serve at the pleasure of other people.
Okay.
And as long as I you know, have a, this is a dream job for somebody like me.
Are you going to get back to biotech?
You know, if the opportunity comes.
Yeah, we got some stuff out in Silicon Valley you might want to test.
There's a lot of fun. I love what goes on, and that's an area that continues to improve all of our lives. Mm-hmm. It has a huge impact, not
Absolutely.
Only on healthcare costs.
No, we haven't even gotten the beginning of it.
Oh, we're not even there. And I'm a big believer that molecular biology is going to ultimately address issues like cancer and other diseases.
You know, the Silicon Valley moguls don't want to die. They're working on that.
They're all working towards
They're working towards it.
Yeah, no,
you're going to have to do antitrust for people who are 300 years old. Anyway, I really appreciate this. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
This is a fascinating discussion. I do want to talk more about legal issues as we go forward, especially like you were talking about around headlines, like break them up or whatever. I want to get into a little more sophisticated discussion about that. But I appreciate your coming to talk. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed the interview as much as I did, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also find more episodes of Recode Decode on Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts. If you didn't like the interview or just want to say hi, tweet at me. I'm at Kara Swisher on Twitter. But James Woods, please stop texting at me. Now that you're done with this, go out and check out our latest episode of Recode Media. You can find that show wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening to this episode of Recode Decode, and thanks to our editor, Joel Robbie, and our producer, Eric Johnson. I'll be back here on Monday. Tune in then.
This podcast was supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.